Hello and welcome to the Physics 100 lecture for March 4th, 2009. Please pick up the accompanying PDF file entitled P100_030409, which should be on the web at a link that is next to this audio link. I'm going to post a class presentation topic list now that you're through exam one, and I want you to look over that list. Basically, these are your choices for group topics for presentations that we're going to do at the end of the semester. I'm going to give you a couple of days after spring break where you can petition for new topics to go on the list, and then what will happen is I'll give the list to you and ask you to give me about five choices in order of preference of topics that you would like to participate in for the presentation. And then I will form groups of roughly even size around nuclei of people that have particular interests. And then we can start the presentation part of the class going so you can begin thinking about your topics. I hope you have time to listen to this before you return from spring break, because the Monday you return, I'll be building on this material. In the meantime, I hope you have a wonderful spring break, and I'll see you afterwards. So, last lecture, so I'm now on page two. Last lecture, we discussed quantum uncertainty, or began to discuss quantum uncertainty. And when we talk about quantum mechanics, what we really mean is the physics that comes out of the wave equation that is written once you realize that massive particles are actually waves. You have to write a wave equation and then solve that in order to understand what the nature's constraints are on those waves, given whatever forces and environment they find themselves in. Okay, and so this is true for electrons traveling in a metal lattice. This is true for electrons around a proton or a nucleus. It's true for any situation in which you find a particle. Basically, it's a massive particle. It's going to be a wave, and if you want to understand exactly what's going on, you have to solve it as a wave. And that wave equation is what we typically call Schrodinger's equation. And what happens when you solve Schrodinger's equation, basically, this is a general wave equation. You input into Schrodinger's equation the nature of the environment and the force that the wave, where the wave is found, and then you solve it. And when you solve it, you find that there are, typically, if it's within an attractive force, you'll find that there are very particular allowed energies and spatial configurations for the particle wave, or the electron in the case of an atom. So, two examples. If you look at the where I have the capital A, pink capital A, surrounded in a circle in the middle of the page, the hydrogen atom is one example, and when you solve Schrodinger's equation for the electron around it, a positive charge like the proton, you get a number of possible states, which I select three particular ones and put them over to the right, where you have red dots representing a nucleus, and then yellow regions around it, the nucleus, which are the spatial configuration states where the electron might be found. And here are just three different ones that I happen to choose out of a large series of possible states. If you look down at the bottom of the page, and where I have the B, the pink B, I have another example. If an electron is passing through a very narrow slit, and you wanted to know where is that electron after it passes through the slit, for example, then quantum mechanics would determine that for you. It would tell you, in principle, where you might find the electron. Actually, though, things are fuzzier than that. What quantum mechanics really tells you is the wave function of the particle, which we denote by psi, usually psi of x, where x here really represents any sort of three-dimensional coordinate, just sort of a spatial position. So let's go to slide 3. Turns out that this quantity psi of x, which you find in the Schrodinger's equation and you solve for, is not actually well defined. It's not actually even understood what it really means in and of itself. We don't know how to interpret the mathematics. We have an equation, and it's an equation for a wave, and in principle, psi of x is the wave function that you put in, and we are used to wave functions from other sorts of waves. Excuse me. We're used to wave functions from other sorts of waves, but in those, the mathematics is a little bit different and easier to interpret. In this case, if you've had a lot of math and you've heard about complex numbers, these are numbers that contain within them something like the square root of minus 1. If you haven't heard of them, don't worry about it. But it turns out that when you add mass into the wave equation, unlike other types of waves, you end up having a complex piece, and it's difficult to interpret exactly what that means. However, if you square psi, that complex piece goes away, and you now have a regular quantity, and it's easy to understand. So if you haven't ever heard of a complex number, don't worry about it. I'm not holding you responsible for it. I just wanted to mention that if you knew what one was. So there are technical reasons why we can't cleanly understand what psi represents by itself. But psi squared actually is very well defined. Psi square of a particle at a certain point in space represents the probability of finding that particle at that point in space. So psi squared, if you were to plot psi square in terms of some sort of spatial coordinate, you would see a distribution that would represent where you're likely to see the particle. So if you flip back to page 2, we're now on page 3, sorry if I didn't mention it earlier. If you flip back to page 2 and you look at example pink A and you look over to the right-hand side, those yellow, the yellow around the nucleus in those three particular states would represent, it's a graphical representation of psi squared. It's the probability of sort of where you will find that electron and when it's sitting in that particular state. Let's go back to slide 3. So let's go back to our slit problem. Imagine that we have a slit where the pink A is, and you have an electron which is going from left to right on the slide in front of you through the slit. When the electron passes through the slit, because the electron is a wave and the slit is very narrow, the electron will diffract just like a water wave going through a slit or any other sort of wave. And what that means is that the wave will spread out. So the electron wave will spread out, which it's no longer... Okay, so we'll come back to that. Where the pink B is, what you see is a line of little detectors. You could think of this as a photographic plate if you want, or electronic detectors. Basically, the green lines going up and down are just little electron detectors that will tell you if an electron hits a certain point. And if I send electron through the slit at A, it will hit the detectors in the back. If the slit is not at A, the electrons will go in a straight line, and they will more or less all hit the detectors at the point which I have denoted with an X with a Roman numeral 3 beside it. Okay. If the electron goes through the slit rather than going unimpeded to the detectors, what happens is the electron gets diffracted. Now, what that really means is that if it were a normal water wave, it would mean that the waves would spread out in much the same way as I have denoted with the wave fronts by the pink C. this makes sense in a water wave because you can sort of see the water wave propagating out. But what does it really mean with the electron? What does it mean in terms of where you'll detect the electron? What it means is that the electron, instead of all of the electrons that you send through the slit, or the single electron that you send through the slit, instead of knowing that it will hit at point 3 on the detectors, where I have the little blue 3, the wave will spread out. So that means that this wave will have, the electron will have a probability of hitting the detectors in some region which is smeared out. So the probability distribution actually will look something like the orange line that I have behind the detectors to the right. That represents psi squared for the electron distribution that you expect. Now I say for 1,000 electrons. So suppose I were to send single electrons through the slit, but instead of sending one of them and looking where it hits, I send 1,000 of them individually, just like a little electron machine gun. Pow, 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 pow. As the electrons go through, each of them will hit the detectors. But in the end, when I look at where all of them have hit, I'll see a smeared out distribution that would look something that would be distributed sort of like this orange curve, where this orange represents the probability of finding the electron, where I'm trying to basically graph the probability of finding the electron on the detectors, which probability is increasing as you go from left to right on this orange curve, so that if you look where the electron hits at point 2, that would be a fairly probable position to hit, and where you see point 1 is not likely to hit. Okay. So this means that for an individual electron, quantum mechanics does not actually tell us where an individual electron will hit the detectors on the right. It will just give us a probability distribution of where the electron is likely to hit. So the electron really could hit anywhere in the region sort of covered by the orange curve. If I were to do 1,000 of them, they would be distributed sort of like the orange curve, but for any individual one, I would not know where it's going to hit. And this is partly what I mean when I talk about the uncertainty of quantum mechanics. All right, so let's finish with page. Okay, let's now go to page 3A. This interpretation of psi and this way of looking at quantum mechanics is often attributed to Max Born, who's a German born in 1882. He won the Nobel Prize in 1954 in physics for his fundamental research in quantum mechanics, especially for his statistical interpretation of the wave function. So he's the one you think of when you look at the, when you say that psi square represents the probability of finding a particle in a region of space. And much of what we're about to talk about in terms of how one looks at psi and tries to figure out what it means in terms of where particles are and the such is often called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. We're going to go now to page 4. All right. Okay, so this is now illustrating, again, what I was trying to say on page 3. The single electron goes through the slit. It's diffracted. We really don't know where it's going to be on the detectors denoted by the pink B. All we can see is, all we could calculate is some sort of probability distribution of where it is most likely to show up. If we go to page 5, the thing is, once the electron actually hits the detector, quantum mechanics knows exactly where it hit. I mean, we know where it hit because we have it in the detector. So in that case, we say that the wave function collapses because there's no probability distribution anymore. The probability is exactly one that it hits where it hits, at the pink C, for example. So the way we say it is we say that the wave function collapses. Your uncertainty is now gone. You don't have some strange distribution of probability to see it. You actually know where it is going to hit. So let's go to page 6. Okay. So let's now look at a two-slit experiment. If we look up at the top plot, imagine I have my little electron machine gun sending lots of individual little electrons, and they go through a double slit at point B, the pink B. And as the electron wave goes through each slit, it will undergo diffraction, and the electron wave will interfere with itself on the right-hand side of the slits. So as you see, the wave fronts for the electron pass through the slits at the pink B up at the top of the page. Those waves will interfere, just like we've seen waves on strings interfere and waves on water interfere. And you will, what the interference will do, if this was waves in the water, you would get regions where you have high amplitude or high probability of the wave being, and you have regions of low probability. So what will happen when the single electron, when you look at the pattern of hits on the screen at the right, which I have denoted by a pink C, you'll see a strange interference pattern. So if you were to have many electrons shot from the machine gun going through the slits, they will hit the detector in sort of the pattern that I've shown. And what you'll see on the pattern at the top of page 6 near the pink C, the green represents sort of some form of a screen of detectors. In this case, I've tried to lay the screen out a little bit so that you can see the pattern on the screen. And the blue X's represent places where the electrons have hit. And what you'll see when you look at this is vertically, as you look at it, you'll see regions where you have lots of hits and regions where you have very few hits. And this is what we call the interference pattern. Basically, it is the wave passes through both of the slits at the pink B, and the wave that passes through the top slit interferes with the wave that passes through the bottom slit, and you form this strange interference pattern. And if you were to calculate in quantum mechanics the psi squared, it would actually look like a series of highly probable regions and low probability regions on the screen. And this is denoted by where you're seeing the electrons on the screen. Okay, so now let's imagine what would happen if we blocked one of the two slits and we had our beam of electrons going. So we put a blockage in front of one of the slits at the pink D, and we have the same beam of electrons coming to hit the slit at F, and these electrons will then be diffracted, just as we saw on page 4, if you look through page 4, and as you remember on page 4, there was a probability distribution which has sort of smeared the diffracted electron out. And so if we go to the bottom of page 6, if you look at the pattern of the electron hits on the detector for many electrons going through the single slit, this is by the pink E, you'll see that the pattern is rather different from what we see at the top of page 6. You no longer have interference of the electron with itself as it goes through the two slits because you blocked one of the slits, so it's now a single slit, just like we did. This means that the wave function basically collapses from the two-slit interference pattern into a single-slit pattern where you know pretty much where the electron's going to hit. And these two patterns are very distinct, okay? And they're quite different from what you might expect classically. If the electron were not a wave, then what you would expect to see, Now you'll have to hold on. I've prepared these slides, and I want to now create a slide while I'm talking to you. So I'm going to call this page 6A because I'm inserting it after page 6, and I already have page 7 in place. Classically, what you would expect to see if we have a single slit or a double slit, and we have electrons moving from left to right. So we have the single slit on top, the double slit on the bottom. In this case, the electron is just like a marble. So the electron is like a stream of marbles or something, or bullets. And now if I look at the detector to the right of the screen, what you'll get really are hits, all the hits at one point on the screen for the top figure, because the electron is like bullets going through a hole, and the bullets will only hit one point on the wall behind. In the case of the bottom, the electron is either going to go through the top slit and hit one point, or through the bottom slit, but not both. So it's one or the other. So this is the classical behavior on page 6A. This is quite distinct from what you see on page 4 and page 6, where the electron is treated as a wave. We know that because the electron is a wave, we have diffraction and we have interference, and the pattern is seen on the screen that way. Okay, very different from classical situation. All right, so if all this isn't weird enough, let's go to slide 7. Slide 7 at the top, I would like to imagine, let me go back to slide 6 for a moment. If we look at slide 6 at the top, I want you to recall that if we have a stream of electrons going through a double slit, the electron wave interferes with itself, and you get an interference pattern on the screen to the right, which is a series of bright and dark fringes, or a series of places where the detector sees electrons interspersed with places where you do not. Okay, this is what we call the interference pattern. This is what you expect from quantum mechanics. Now I'm going to show you something very strange. If we go back to slide 7 and we look at the top, if we imagine that we allow the electron to pass through the double slit pattern just like it did on slide 6 at the top, but now we put what I call a non-destructive detector, so something that sits apart from the slits and doesn't destroy the electron as it passes through, or any piece of the electron wave that passes through. It just makes an observation and can tell us whether the electron went through the top slit or the bottom slit. Okay? And suppose basically we look at the pattern that we see if we know whether the electron goes through the top slit or the bottom slit. We no longer get the interference pattern. In fact, the knowledge of the electron passing through the slit is enough to collapse the wave function. So quantum mechanics is very strange this way. I hope this sounds very weird to you, but the truth is, in quantum mechanics, the observer can change the wave function, in a sense. And this is not something we've ever seen before. If you have bullets passing through these slits, and I have a little external bullet detector that doesn't deflect the bullet, you're going to still see the two hits on the screen, just like we had on page 6A at the bottom. Or if you had a single slit, just like you'd have on page 6A at the top. But in this case, just creating the knowledge of just knowing whether the wave passed through the top or the bottom is enough to collapse the interference patterns. It's sort of like saying the electron is a wave and interferes with itself as it's passing through the two slits, as long as we don't have the knowledge of where the electron is, so long as we don't specify where it is. But the moment we specify where it is, it acts more like a marble and it doesn't interfere with itself anymore. Okay, so this is pretty strange business. Last time I told you a little bit about another interesting example of the uncertain in quantum mechanics called Schrodinger's cat. And just to remind you, if in this case we have a cat in a box with a radioactive substance that has a 50-50% probability of decaying, a 50-50 chance, and if it does, it will hit a detector which releases poison gas and kills the cat. And in quantum mechanical calculations, we really don't know whether the cat is alive. All we know is there's a 50% chance that this thing has decayed or hasn't decayed, but we don't know which without looking in the box. And within quantum mechanics, you really don't try to resolve this without looking in the box. You actually really model the cat as being half alive and half dead. So this doesn't sit too well with a lot of people. Einstein didn't like it at all. In fact, if we go to slide 8, there's something which is known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, the EPR paradox, which these guys floated in 1935, and they really didn't like this uncertainty in quantum mechanics, calling it spooky action at a distance. And I want to give you an example of what I mean by very spooky action at a distance. On the left-hand side, I have two round black dots that decay. These I'll call particles called pions. And I want you to imagine that we have sitting in the lab a particle called a pion, which I represent with the black dots on the left-hand side of this plot. So it turns out that we're going to let this pion, or pions will decay into two photons. All right, this just happens to be what pions do. And it turns out that photons have a spin. We've talked a bit about spin. In detail what it is, let's not worry about it so much, but it can have an orientation. All right, so the photon has spin 1, so if you look over at the pink A, I'm going to denote the spin in a certain way. We're going to imagine that the spin is like a football. All right, imagine the photon is like a football, which can either spin relative to its direction of motion. If you were to be a quarterback and throwing a football, all right, and you were able to look at the football as it flies through the air, if you threw it with your right hand, you spin the football as it leaves your fingers, and it would be spinning clockwise relative to your eye. If you threw it left-handed, you would have a spin, but it would be spinning counterclockwise. So obviously a photon isn't a football, but mathematically we sort of have the same type of game. We say that a photon has spin, and the spin could have one of two orientations. It could either, if you're looking from the source of the particle, the spin can be oriented sort of clockwise or counterclockwise. So at the pink A, I'm going to denote the photon movement by V, sort of an arrow denoted by V. And the spin could be oriented one of two ways. So beneath the V, you see a little arrow denoted by S. This is one type of spin, where the spin would, say, be clockwise. And then beneath that S is another little spin arrow, which also is denoted S. And if I were to draw it in the direction away from the velocity, the spin would be going counterclockwise. Okay, so we're looking at the pink A on slide 8. And I draw the direction of a photon. And if I were to draw the little S in the same direction as the direction of the photon, the spin would be one way. If I drew it the other direction, so not the direction of the photon, so the arrow little S is moving opposite the direction of little arrow V, then the photon would have the spin the other way. All right. So sorry, this is sort of complicated. So now what's going to happen is the pion is going to decay into two photons. So when that happens, let's look at case one on the left. You have one pion, which is the black round dot, that then decays. It disappears. When it disappears into two photons. Okay? And two photons could be produced moving in the directions given by the little V arrows. The pion has now disappeared, and observers A and B, represented by eyeballs, could see these photons. Okay? Now, turns out that there is something called conservation of spin, which is an important principle in particle physics and quantum mechanics, that basically correlates the spin of the two photons, which means you'll notice that in case one, if you look at the spin, the little spin arrows are both going in the direction of the respective photons. And you'll note that they are opposite in direction, which means the spin of the two photons that are created when the pion decays are correlated. And the observers at A and B could see that if they could compare notes. Okay. Similarly, we could have case two, where the two photon spins again are correlated, but you'll note the only difference in case two is the pion decays, goes into two photons, the photons are moving away from one another. In this case, the spin is against the motion of the photons, so the spin is the opposite direction. Right. So these two photons are produced at a single time and they are correlated. If one of them, say the one detected by observer A, has the spin arrow aligned along the velocity, then we know that the one at spin B will also have that. In the case two, if observer A sees the spin going against the velocity, then we know that that's what observer B would see. So we call this sort of state, where because the two particles are formed together and they're correlated in this way, we call it an entangled quantum state. Now the thing is, in quantum mechanics, there's a 50-50 probability of having the spins oriented as like in case one or as case two. Half the time you'll get case one, half the time you'll get case two. In any individual pion decay, you don't know whether it's case one or case two. All you know is that you have a 50% probability of being in one or the other. Okay? So this is what quantum mechanics calculates for you. Now, I'd like you to imagine that observer A actually sees a photon, right? Observer A sees one of these and can determine whether they see a photon with the spin oriented like case one or whether they see the photon with the spin oriented like case two. Once they see the photon and they've determined which case they have, it immediately determines the spin that would be seen by observer B. We say that it collapses the wave function. So from the point of view of quantum mechanics, before either observer sees those photons, the photons exist in a state that's half like case 1 and half like case 2, and quantum mechanics has no preference for the two. So the wave function doesn't give you any information as to the specific state of the photon, just the distribution of states. At the very instant that observer A sees a photon, it determines the wave function throughout. In other words, it tells, even if these photons are decaying from the pion and then travel, you know, a half a light year away from one another, okay? We have a pion decay here in New York, and the photons go off into space, and one of them is a half light year in one direction, and one of them is a half light year in the other direction. And by light year, I mean it takes a year for light to go that far. So these are extreme distances, all right? If observer A was sitting out and observed at that point in space, you know, a half light year away, that their photon has spin corresponding to case 1, it immediately determines what observer B would see. And we can do this in the laboratory, and observer B will always see the spin that is correlated properly with what observer A sees. So if you try to think about how the information flows, how, for example, does the photon, where observer B sees it, how does it know what observer A saw? We say in quantum mechanics that the wave function collapses, but how is that information conveyed? Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen pointed out that it seems as if that information has to flow faster than the speed of light for it to be basically instantaneous across vast distances in principle. So they call this the EPR paradox. It's as if the interpretation of quantum mechanics that I'm floating for you has within it sort of faster than light travel for information in a sense. It's a paradox. So there are two ways to actually look at this. If we go to slide 9, in slide 9, one way is what I've basically been telling you. It's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in this, you sort of say, well, this wave function isn't real. It's like a mathematical tool, and we don't really have reality in the system until somebody makes an observation, in which case you have to worry about faster than light travel. So it's a little bit fuzzy. It's almost as if, well, we just don't worry about it because we're not quite attributing reality to the wave function itself anyway. It's only after an observation is made that something is real. This, of course, is a little fuzzy, and lots of people don't like it. There's another point of view, which is called the many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, you would say, well, we know that the photon has a half a chance of being oriented like case 1 in the pion decay, and a half a chance, I mean, and a 50% probability of being oriented as case 2. Actually, it is both. The universe breaks into two, and in one universe it's oriented one way, and the other universe it's oriented the other way. And this gets rid of all uncertainty in the problem, in that in one universe, A will see the spin as case 1, and of course B will see the spin as case 1, because in that universe, the photons are in that state, case 1 spin state. In another universe, they see case 2. And again, in that universe, it's 100% probability they'll see case 2. And this is called the many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. I don't actually know of a way to distinguish between these two ways of viewing the world. If I had to guess, most physicists, if they had to vote, would sort of be comfortable with the Copenhagen interpretation, because after you do lots of calculations using the Copenhagen interpretation, you sort of become used to it, and you're not too bothered by these things that much. The mini world sounds a little bizarre, like you have all of these multiple universes around. I mean, if you think about the vast number of quantum processes that are happening all the time, and if you were to divide the universe every time you have any sort of quantum process happen, at any given instant, you would have just an incredible number of universes out there. So the whole idea is a little bit strange, but scientifically, is it ruled out? No, it's consistent with what we see, just like the Copenhagen interpretation is consistent with what we see. This strange effect of this entangled photon state is actually quite real, and is seen by Len Mandel, who is a famous physicist who died in 2001. He was here at the University of Rochester. These entangled quantum states are quite real, and it's a current area of hot research to see if one can use these for quantum cryptography. So one basically uses it. You can use these entangled quantum states and send information to multiple people, but unless you know what state the one of the observers saw when they sent the message or something, you won't know what the message is if you're on the other side. I'm not going to worry about it saying more. At any rate, it's a hot area of research, and it actually will likely have very practical applications. So let's go to slide 10. Another example of the uncertainty in quantum mechanics is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is stated, I have it written by the pink A, delta X times delta P is less than a constant, which is H over 2 pi. Okay, H is Planck's constant. If you recall, it's around 10 to the minus 34. So that's a very small number. And on the left-hand side of the equation, where the pink A is, we have delta X times delta P. What do those represent? Delta X is, this is for any system, delta X represents your uncertainty in the position of that system. So let's say the system is just a particle, okay, some electron floating through space. Delta X would represent your knowledge of how well you know where that electron is at any given time, okay? Delta P represents the uncertainty in the momentum of that electron, which is, remember that momentum is mass times velocity. So it's basically your uncertainty in how fast and what direction that electron is going, all right? Now, if we're not talking about... So what Heisenberg says is that within quantum mechanics, we actually cannot know both the position and the momentum of a particle with infinite precision. All right? There has to be some uncertainty, and the product of the uncertainties in the two is less than a small number. So if we look at equation A, what it says is, if I know very precisely what the position is, so imagine delta X is extraordinarily small, then delta P is going to be big. Oh, I have the uncertainty going the wrong way. Sorry, when I first wrote this, I have to... Sorry, I had equation A wrong. I just had to fix it so that my discussion would make sense. All right. delta x times delta p is greater than some small number. So that means if I have perfect information on the position of a particle, then the momentum is unknown, because I have to have the product of these two be some greater than some small number. If I know the momentum very well, so I know the direction and velocity of the particle very, very well, then I don't really know where it is very well. So this is what Heisenberg says. And this may sort of sound crazy, but it's really a statement that in the universe, size really does matter. The reason that this statement sounds very funny and sort of arbitrary to us is that we live in a universe, in our personal worlds, where this isn't an issue. For example, if you see a car, let's imagine point B, pink B, and it's going down the road, and you want to know exactly where it is and its momentum, if you were a cop, for example, what could you do? Well, you could shoot light at the car. You could shoot light at a couple of different times and look at where the reflections occur. And from the distance between the reflections and the time between the light pulses, you could calculate how fast the car is going. Where you saw the reflections tells you where the car is. And in our world of large bodies, this is fine. And you can know it to arbitrary precision. This is the Newtonian world. And in this Newtonian world, I can know the position and momentum of a particle to arbitrary precision without any problem. Imagine trying to do the same thing for a little tiny electron, which is, I denote at C, pink C. Now, if you try to do exactly the same thing to the electron, when the light hits it, remember light is like a particle to something small like an electron, and the light actually moves the electron when it hits it. So when light hits a car, it doesn't change the motion of the car. It doesn't affect it at all. But when light hits a little electron, it would be like hitting your car with a small truck. It does affect the direction of the electron and its velocity, potentially. So although you may, when you hit the electron with the light, you may know, so I haven't told you, the light is represented by the sort of red-yellow circles, and the path of the light is represented by the red arrows in the two cases. When you hit an electron with a photon, it's like hitting it with a Mack truck or something. It moves it. So you may know exactly where the electron was by looking at where the reflection of the light is, but you'll no longer know how fast or in what direction it's going because it's been changed by the photon. So in quantum mechanics, when you go to the world of the very small, which is really what quantum mechanics deals with, because that's where particles have wavelengths, size really does matter. And it basically means, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle has a big effect. It's true, you cannot know both where something is and its momentum simultaneously. And this really destroys any hope that we would have for living in a fully deterministic universe. Remember, I've told you all along that part of the game of physics is to determine the forces of nature. And the reason for this is because if you know the forces, you can know the accelerations and you can predict the future. If you know where everything is and their velocity, so if you know the position and velocity of everything in the universe perfectly and you know the forces that are on it and you on each of the particles in the universe and you input this into some computer, a huge computer, and run it through F equals MA for some amount of time, you basically would know where everything is and how fast it's going in the future. And so we say that the universe is completely deterministic in this picture. Well, with quantum mechanics, it tells you that I may know where particles are, but I can't know how fast they're going to start with, or if I know how fast they're going, I can't know where they are. So I have inherent uncertainty in the initial conditions at any given moment. And that tells me that I no longer can calculate the future of the universe. So with the advent of quantum mechanics, we have truly given up the deterministic universe. So I'd like to go now to slide 11. There's a different form of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's a little less intuitive, but it's also quite true. And what it says is that the uncertainty in the energy of a particle times the uncertainty in the time over which it exists is greater than a constant. So this means that if I have an electron and I know it exists for, how do I say this right? What this really says, if I have a state if it exists for an extraordinarily short time, that is, I know exactly when it exists, okay, I know what its lifetime is very precisely, and it's very short, for example, because if it's very short, then I know precisely what my uncertainty in the lifetime over which it exists can't be any greater than its lifetime. Then I don't know what energy it had. I have great uncertainty in that. So this actually may sound a little strange, a little less intuitive than the last one. But it opens up Pandora's box in a sense. What I'm saying, according to this principle, is I can break conservation of energy so long as I do it over an extraordinarily short time. So that it's basically unobservable. This has tremendous implications. So this sounds Harry Potterish, and it is. We really do live in a Harry Potterish universe, okay? Harry Potter universe. So if you look down at the bottom of page 11, I have three electrons, basically. I'm going to say three electrons traveling through space. Now, let's look at the one signified by A. So for the electron A, this electron is bebopping through space, but you can't look at it as a marble anymore. Remember, the electron is basically some superposition of whatever quantum states it could be, according to quantum mechanics. All right? And what the uncertainty principle says is this electron could be bebopping through space, and it could just emit a photon, which I signify by gamma. And in doing so, this electron could basically be breaking conservation of energy. And this is something that's allowed by quantum mechanics so long as this photon comes back and rejoins the electron in a very short time, such that you really can't observe it. We would call this photon a virtual particle. It's not really real, but it could exist in principle. Instead of what happens with the pink A, this electron could do pink B, where the photon is emitted and it turns into an electron and an anti-electron called a positron, and those come back together into a photon, which comes back together to the original electron. This is another possibility of what is allowed, again, breaking conservation of energy, but only over a very, very short time. C is yet another crazy example, where you see photons emitted and particles and antiparticle pairs created and coming back together. And we call these particles that are created but not quite real virtual particles. And if we go to slide 13, why is this important? Well, imagine if I had two electrons. Instead of looking at them as marbles, you look at them as sort of clouds of these virtual particles. Imagine what would happen if one of these crazy virtual particles, instead of being reabsorbed by the same electron, is absorbed by the other. if I imagine the electron as sort of a cloud of these virtual particles are carrying the characteristics of that electron, a net electric charge of and a net momentum and everything. And if I exchange one of these virtual particles with a different particle, I'm actually exchanging momentum. And this, as bizarre as it is the essence of a force in quantum mechanics. It's the field of study which does this. It's called quantum field theory. And in this theory, this is the essence of how forces are conveyed. And the different nature of the forces that we see in nature comes about by the nature of the particle that gets conveyed. In the case of electromagnetism, the virtual particle that's conveyed from one particle to another is the photon, and this determines the characteristics of electromagnetism. We'll come back to this. Basically, these virtual particles or forces are only existing because of this loophole in the deterministic universe that's created by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So, we'll come back to that in another class. By my watch, I've been going about an hour. I believe that I go substantially faster in this mode of operation than I do when I'm in class drawing a lot of these things rather than just referring to them. So I believe I've certainly covered plenty of material for one lecture, and it turns out to be a very good place to stop. So I will stop here. I hope you all have a good day, and I hope that this works out well for you in terms of mode of learning.